Okay, y'all remember who this was from a few weeks ago? Probably about 6 weeks ago, actually. Begins with a J.
He was the hermit that lived in the cave for a while.
Yeah, that was...
Did lots of translating, ended up in Bethlehem.
Jerome. This was Jerome. Jerome was a guy that wrote the Latin Bible for us and those kind of things. Okay, a little bit further back, who was this guy? Eusebius. He was the guy that was with Constantine, did a lot of writing and that kind of thing, one of the early church fathers. Just to bring those back. Jerome is not quite a contemporary of Leo, but he's not very far from him in terms of his life. And in some ways he was a contemporary of him. But this is Leo, and this is a statue of him, or a carving of him. This is from at St. Peter's Basilica. And it's just a rendition of him. There's also inside the basilica, there's also a St. Leo's altar, they call it. I'm not sure all that they do there, but that's another point of attraction for the folks that visit St. Peter's Basilica and that kind of thing. But going on to talk about Leo today. Leo was born in what we think was about 400 AD. That's what the scholars think. And if you remember back, Jerome is going to be with us until, I believe, about 420 AD, something like that. Tradition says his father was a Tuscan named Quintarian. He lived in a little town called Volterra, which was just on the north side of Eutoria. And don't ask me exactly where that is in Italy, but I just know he's from Italy. The interesting thing about him is that he's the first Latin-speaking pope. Everyone else before that had been Greek and that type of thing, but he's going to be the first Latin-speaking pope. It was inferred from his education that he grew up with basically a Christian and a Latin culture. And they say that because in his writings there's this absence of any type of pagan references and those kind of things. And he, matter of fact, says that he is ignorant of Greek. So this is Leo. Put the stuff up there to show you that he doesn't have this rich kid resume kind of thing like we saw in Jerome, where his parents were able to send him to the fine places and he goes off on this life finding myself kind of quest. You don't read that about Jerome. Or excuse me, about Leo. But how did he get here? Well, first of all, this acolyte and the Pelagian controversy. I don't know if y'all remember the Pelagian controversy, but Pelagian controversy had to deal with the idea of original sin, and that man wasn't necessarily born with original sin. Pelagius is who this is named after. Pelagius said, "I can choose for myself not to sin," and so there was this controversy going on. At the time, Leo was an acolyte, and I believe I wrote it down here so I wouldn't forget. There was a Pope Zimonius, that would allow Leo or had Leo communicate, bringing the letters from him out to the church at Africa, the African church they called it. But he was the guy, the carrier of information between those two. And Augustine mentions him in a letter. That's the only reason we know about it, is that Augustine wrote about Leo doing this kind of thing, and they assume it's the same Leo. The next thing I have on here is that he's going to be an archdeacon of Rome under Celestine. Celestine's reign is from 422 to 433, so he's holding these positions within the Church of Rome itself. The next thing I have on here is Cassian. Now, again, this is people writing and letting us know what Leo's doing. Leo's not writing about himself doing these things, but this guy named Cassian, he's a contemporary of Leo's. And he comes from, he brought the Egyptian monasticism to the West. In other words, some of the ideas that monks had and those kind of things from Egypt, he brought those to the West. But he also had these ideas on incarnation. And he wasn't this guy, big writer or anything like that. He really just didn't, that wasn't his strong point. And he needed some encouragement, and Leo was a guy to encourage him to write. So our friend Cassian there writes some information about the incarnation that's well received, In there, Leo, Cassian writes about Leo calling him the ornament of the Roman Church and the end of the divine ministry. So it's kind of not so much a dedication, but at least recognizing his contribution in encouraging Cassian to write this. The next thing we're going to see in the life of Leo has to do with Cyril. And Cyril has an issue here. Cyril is concerned about, there are a couple things that Cyril's going to do, but one of the things in particular, there's this church in Jerusalem and a guy named Juvenal. Juvenal wants the church in Jerusalem to be recognized kind of on par with the church in Rome, with the church at Antioch. He wants them to be, not, I guess I want to say autonomous in terms of how they're viewed. Right at this point in time, you've got these, I want to call them mega churches, but they're centers in which the churches exercise influence over the territory. Rome is one of them. Constantinople is going to be one of them. Athens is one of them. Antioch. And there's one other one. Alexandria, thank you. Alexandria. They exercise influence in their regions, and they want Jerusalem to be recognized like that. Now then, Cyril's not a big popular fan of this type of thought. And so he wants to get, he wants to influence the Pope, of the Bishop of Rome about this at the time. And so he writes to Leo, he said, use your influence so we can stop this thing. We don't have that to go through. And so that's how Leo is viewed, as someone who can kind of get things done, not in a manipulative way, but certainly he has influence and insight. And to be honest, if Leo didn't agree with him, it wouldn't get done. Leo was a very strong individual as well. And we're going to hear more about that a little bit later. But this had to do with the Council of Ephesus in 431, that he's trying to get this done. That issue doesn't go away, okay? And just kind of file that back in your memory there. So going on, how did we get here? How did Leo get here? Sixtus is going to be the Bishop of Rome, or Pope, if you will, from 432 until 440. And this thing's called the Prosperous Chronicon. And Prosperous Chronicon is, if you will, Pastor, you may help me with this thing. It's basically just a ledger of things that have been going on, kind of a chronicle, if you will, of things going on. And in 439, there's this Julius of Elicon, and he's a supporter of Nestorius, who's, we know, not one of the good guys. But he's been deprived of an office of bishop, and now he's trying to obtain that position. And Leo doesn't like Nestorius, any of the supporters of Nestorius. Leo doesn't believe the church should have anything to do with. And so there's this note in here in 439 that Leo is going to work with Sixtus, or at least persuade Sixtus to not provide any type of opportunity for this Julius to become a bishop. In doing so, as Leo's going through this, Julius says that he's no longer a supporter of Nestorius, but Leo wants him to have a formal tome written out saying that he supports, if you will, the dual nature of Christ, and not just say, I don't do it, but he wants a statement from him. And that's one of the reasons that Leo is so adamant about him not receiving this office of bishop. That kind of makes sense? So he's somewhat of a defender of the faith, a defender of the church, and that's how he views himself. And again, Leo uses his influence with the bishop of Rome at that time, Sixtus, to gain that. Now Leo, because of his ability to work with people, to influence them, to negotiate, he's called into this political mission in 440. And I have up there reconcile quarreling between, there's a general Aetius and a general Albinius, and they're rival generals within the Roman army. Now Leo was successful in arbitrating a truce between these two generals that were kind of fighting amongst themselves. This request came from both Sixtus and also from the emperor at the time to get this resolved. And again, here it is, going through the church to resolve a military issue. Seems kind of strange to me, but that's the Leo that we are talking about today. Now, while he's away at this mission, Sixtus is going to pass away. And while he's away, Leo, the group comes together and votes and decides Leo is going to be the next bishop of Rome. So that's how Leo comes to power. Does that kind of make sense? So on September 29th, 440 AD, Leo is ordained Pope of Rome. And Pope of Rome and Bishop of Rome are the same type of title and everything. Now he's the 47th Pope of Rome, and he's going to preach sermons at the ordination, and there are two points he's going to make. One of the points is he's going to extol his entrance into the office, saying the glory of the blessed Apostle Peter, in whose chair his power lives on and his authority shines forth. So basically he's referring to this Bishop of Rome now as something that had been established by God through Peter to the church at Rome. The church at Rome has typically been associated with both Peter and Paul. Peter, who we'll read about in just a few minutes, is who they really key in on for this church at Rome and this office. Not so much it's Leo, but it's this office of Bishop of Rome that is traditionally like the spiritual descendant, if you will, of Peter that they want to go on to. But within that same sermon, he's also going to chastise the Bishop of Aquileia and his fellow bishops for not dealing with the Pelagianism issues of their provinces. And the only reason I write that down is that we see Leo starting out early now to exercise authority over the region now, saying that, hey, y'all messed up, and this is what I think. And we're going to see that carry on, because Leo really wants to see the church in a strong position. And that's one of the reasons, too, he refers to Peter in this. He's not so much interested in building himself up as he is building up that office within the office of the Bishop of Rome.
Is that a type of other religion or something? No,
those were the guys that were saying, Pelagius was saying that I don't have an inherent sin nature. I can choose not to sin and I will be sinless. Whereas the belief of the church at that time, the main belief was that I have my original sin, the sin that I'm born with, plus I'm sinful by nature. And Pelagius was saying, no, you can. I choose not to sin. I don't really need a Savior. Is that about right, Pastor?
He didn't quite deny the need for a Savior. But yeah, it was very choice-driven rather than the nature-driven.
Well, within that sermon that Leo preaches, he's going to make three references here within his sermon. He's going to choose Matthew 16:13-19, which says, when Jesus came into the region of Caesarea, he asked his disciples, saying, who do men say that I am? Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? So they said, some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So this is one of the verses he's talking about. And again, as Leo's interpreting this, he's interpreting it not just to Peter, but Peter's descendants and Peter's church that he's alluding to. He also uses Luke 22:31-32, in which, and the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Leo's going to pick up on this strengthen your brethren as saying that, yeah, Peter's position within the apostolic ranks was strengthening his brethren. And as office of bishop within the office of bishop at the Church of Rome, their position there is to strengthen the brethren or strengthen the church. And finally, he uses John 21:15-17. So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." Again, this was just him reiterating the responsibility Peter had, in which the office now of bishop had the same responsibility. And that's what he's trying to say on this. And though we as Protestants don't believe that that's the way it was handed down or that's the way it should be interpreted, that's the way Leo was interpreting this at the time. The other thing I wanted to add too is that roughly 100 years prior to this, we saw Constantine using the church as, if you will, a cement for the empire. Remember, they were having the issues, and he called the Council of Nicaea, and he said, "You guys get together. I'm ordering you guys to get together, get this resolved, because you're not going to fracture the church, because y'all are the guys that are going to hold our empire together." And now we see Leo taking the same stance in terms of building up the church and using this philosophy, if you will, for establishing the church at Rome as being the supreme church, or the supreme, I guess, holding the office of bishop, being the primacy is the proper word they call that thing. But really, it's kind of like the supreme or the head, which is interesting because as Pastor Tim was talking to me, he was saying, you know, Christ didn't tell his disciples to elevate yourself one over the other. And yet Leo, in this instance, he is elevating the church at Rome over the other churches that are around him. But things aren't all the way over. There are other issues at this time. So he's got to start. But the other things going on is we're seeing decline in the Roman Empire right now. These are whittling down to the latter years of the Roman Empire. So we're seeing a decline in the Roman Empire, both from a military and even in terms of wealth and that type of thing, the Roman Empire's dwindling. There's a decline in paganism in terms of just the way the Romans were living and that kind of thing. So that's somewhat of a good thing. But they're still seeing this decline in paganism, and they're also seeing a decline in learning and thought. Now, we in our position today know that the Dark Ages are just around the corner, but that's the type of environment that Leo's in right now as we see the church going through this, getting ready to enter into this. Now, the one thing he does have going for him is the church at Rome. The church at Rome has approximately 30,000 members. It's the largest church in that area. It's the wealthiest church. They have 150 clerics. And in terms of wealth, they provide support for 1,500 widows and poor people. So they are trying to carry out the mission of the church, plus they're able to do that. They also have the reputation for orthodoxy and clarity. So that's what Leo has starting out as bishop of this church. Now, I throw this map up here, and I know what I want y'all to see is the red portion. That's going to be considered, if you will, the Western Empire over here of the Roman Empire. The kind of greenish or gray-looking stuff that you see there, that's going to be considered the Eastern Empire. Because, hopefully I did this right. No, I'm going to go up one more. Because at this time, you have Eastern emperors and Western emperors. So those are the men during Leo's reign as Pope. Remember, he started in 440. He's going to go on until about 461. That's when he passes away. But during that 21 years, he's going to have men going through here as emperors, and we'll talk about some of them later. But Theodosius, when he comes into office, Theodosius is going to be the emperor of the East, and in the West, we'll have Valentinian III. Let me back up one. But like I said, there was more stabilization that was going to be done for Leo, and as he's building the church, so to speak, or establishing himself, not so much himself, I guess I want to say, but the office of bishop in Rome. Emperor Valentinian III is going to issue a decree in 445, and this decree is going to require that all the local bishops attend the papal court. What's the significance of that? He wants to make sure everybody's on the same page. And if you don't do that, he compelled Antius, he was one of the guys, the generals that were arguing, that Leo had worked with, he's going to compel him to go out and round them up and bring them to the court. That's right. If you can come willfully, or you can, or I will drag you there, but you're going to come and we're going to all be on the same page. In a statement that the emperor had made, he said, as the primacy, and again, that's kind of like the superiority or the superiority of the apostolic see, and who's the apostolic see? Leo. That is his office. So, as for the superiority or the primacy of the apostolic see is based on the title of the Blessed Peter, Prince of the Episcopal Dignity, on the dignity of the city of Rome, and on the decision of the Holy Synod, no illicit steps may be taken against this see to usurp its authority. For the only way to safeguard peace among the churches everywhere is to acknowledge its leadership universally. So, with this little statement in 445, we see that Leo has a strong church, he's got wealth, he has people. Now he's got the imperial side of it from this edict from the emperor supporting him. Plus he has this little military component that says, if you don't go along with me, you will go along with me. So this is how the Western side of the church is being built up under Leo. And again, we don't see Leo necessarily driving these things from look at what I did, but these things are working out for a reason. Again, there are Eastern and Western emperors. But things aren't always rosy for Leo because he's got these two council meetings that happen. There's a robber council meeting that happens in roughly 449. And remember, the robber council meeting was attended by about 150 guys or so. This is 150, and this is over in the west, in the east, excuse me. And it took place in Ephesus, I believe it was. It was not formally recognized by the church. A guy named Dioscorus ran the meeting, and the issue had been Eutycles. Eutycles had been the guy that had been opposed to the dual nature of Christ. He said that there was the divine nature, there's the human nature, but the human nature gets kind of absorbed by the divine nature, and Christ is a divine, multi-faceted kind of divinity, if you will. Has all this wrapped up into him. One nature, but it's all kind of mangled in there. The church on the other side, the Western church, maintained the dual nature. Christ was fully human, he was fully God, but it was one person. And Eutycles, as well as Dioscorus, didn't want to play along with that. So, you know, Eutycles had been sanctioned prior to this. They had the robbers meeting, a robbers council meeting. He was exonerated, and that flew in the face of Leo and all the Western side of things. I actually found an error that I had on my presentation from last time. There was a guy named Flavian that I had on there attending the Chalcedon council meeting. But Flavian had actually attended the robber council meeting, and Flavian had opposed Dioscorus as well as Eutycles on this issue. Well, as a result of him opposing them, he was actually beaten up. He was beaten to the point that they threw him in prison, and he died a few days later. He didn't even make it back to the Western side. So Leo wasn't aware of this thing. He couldn't go to this robbers' council meeting, and he had sent some of his envoy, and Flavian had been one of them. Flavian didn't make it back. Kind of a sad thing about that, and I'm sorry that I didn't get that right the first time. So now we've got a problem. We've got this robber council meeting, all this stuff had happened. Well, remember, Theodosius is the emperor at the time when the robber meeting was called. they were able to kind of manipulate him. And Theodosius, the emperor on the east, had said, okay, we'll have this council meeting thing. They had orchestrated that and gotten that worked out. Well, Theodosius now dies. He's in a horse riding accident. We kind of mentioned that a few weeks back. He's in a horse riding accident, falls, breaks his neck. He's dead. A guy named Marcion takes over. Now, Marcion is more of a conservative, orthodox kind of guy, and Leo likes that. He's able to call this other council, the Council of Chalcedon, which is going to meet October 8th through the 1st. And notice the attendance that's there, 500 to 600 bishops. The other meeting had 150, and prior council meetings barely had 200. So this is, again, more the influence of our emperor saying, you will go to these meetings and that kind of thing. And so we have a large turnout for this thing. Again, the issue is the person of Christ, and the opponents to this are going to be Eutycles and Dioscorus. And we know that from the council that his tome is presented. Leo, unfortunately, can't be at the Chalcedon meeting because he's got problems with Attila that we're going to talk about shortly. And so he's got a concern there. So he sends an envoy there. There's another guy named I circled his name so I would get it right on here. Antiloius, I hope I said that right. Antiloius is going to go kind of in Flavian's spot. Leo's not a big fan of his, but he's going to send him anyway because I got to send somebody. And so he's going, he's got his tome with him along with some other staff members. And so they're going to present at Chalcedon. So at Chalcedon we have that, and then Leo's tome is of significant value to the group. Y'all saw this slide a few weeks ago. It's basically says it's a balanced statement of Chalcedon articulated the fundamental Christian doctrine. From that date forward, most Christians in Catholicism, Protestants, and Orthodoxy looked to Chalcedon for the foundation of the doctrine of salvation, a unique man, God-man, Jesus Christ. It also represented a successful translation of biblical revelation into another conceptual language, that being Latin, that we talked about as well. Ultimately, Dioscorus is going to be deposed. Eutycles is going to be exiled. And again, the whole idea behind Chalcedon is that the framework of Christ, his nature, is going to be put into words and framed in such a way that the dual nature of Christ is going to be understood by all and signed up by, signed to or acknowledged by those men there. Does that kind of make sense? You got it? Now then, we have a couple of encounters here. One's Attila the Hun, and that first takes place in 452. Attila's coming to town, and he needs some money. He wants money. He wants whatever he can get. Pillage, plunder, the whole nine yards. Attila's just kind of ticked off, and he's going to take Italy. Well, he gets to Rome, and there's not really a whole lot of forces or anything like that left. The imperial folks want Leo to go meet Attila. Go talk to him. Well, Leo does what he wants him to do. Leo goes and he goes to talk to him. He brings some of his guys with him, and they go and talk to Attila. Now, the scholars and that kind of stuff tell us that Attila the Hun was having issues back home already, that he had problems with his troops in terms of disease and that kind of thing. He had problems back home with invading forces and that kind of stuff. He was just kind of stretched thin. That's what the scholars are going to tell us about Attila on his end of things. But when Leo and Attila meet, and they're roughly the same age, Leo just says, please don't attack our town. Don't burn it. Don't pillage it. Just don't do it. And for whatever reason, which only God knows, Attila relented. He did not come to Rome. He didn't pillage them or anything like that. He turns his forces around, and they head back home. So there's those that are going to say that, you know, Attila, just he couldn't do it anymore. He couldn't push himself. He wasn't going to push his troops, and he decided to turn and run and go back. Whereas others are going to say, look at what Leo did. Look at how wonderful he did. He turned them away. I don't know how you want to look at that. Either way, that's what happened with Leo in place there. The next problem we have is going to be an encounter with Gesseric with the Vandals. It sounds kind of like a rock band, doesn't it? Gesseric and the Vandals. But that's going to happen in 455 AD. And in 455, it is a very ugly story. Remember that Valentinian III guy that we talked about, the emperor? Well, he's going to have an affair with Maximus' wife. Now, Maximus is going to get ticked off. Pardon? Well, no, it's not that Maximus. Maximus is going to have Valentinian III killed. Once he does that, Maximus kind of rises to power. He ends up marrying Exodotus. Exodotus was the former wife of Valentinian. And for whatever reason, Exodotus finds out that Maximus had a part in her former husband's death, in his assassination. To which she writes a letter to this Gesseric telling him, go attack Rome, pillage and plunder it, do your worst to it. She was just mad about that. Now then Maximus, before Gesseric shows up to town, Maximus is going to be killed. He's out of the picture. Valentinian's out of the picture. We don't have an emperor right now. What are we going to do? Leo, help us. Help us, Leo. So the people go to Leo to get help from him. Meanwhile, Gesseric's coming to town. So again, we have Gesseric and Leo. They meet up. They talk this out. What are we going to do? He had some success with Attila. What's going to happen now? So Leo goes to him and says, look, please don't destroy this place. Please don't do that. Gesseric, though, he's not quite as compassionate maybe as Attila. But Gesseric says, I won't burn the place, but for 14 days, we're going to loot the place. We're taking whatever we want. So for 14 days, Rome is pillaged. They take whatever they want, and then they leave. Now then, some are going to say, that was a victory for Leo. Look what he did. He saved all the precious buildings and everything. No one was killed. They just took some stuff that we can replace. Whereas the others are going to say, look at what Gesseric did. He took all this good stuff for the country. I don't know how you want to look at it, but either way, Leo was involved in negotiating that. I only bring that up to show you the importance now of Leo because, you know, we had this imperial power that was there that's crumbling, military forces kind of crumbling, and yet Leo is going to be known as the protector of Rome now. And not just Leo, but the office of the Bishop of Rome is the protector of the Church of Rome. And this is kind of how everything was built up for Leo. Maybe not to the way he exactly envisioned it, but that's what was going to happen at the end of Leo's reign and everything. Is there anything else you want to add to that, Pastor? Now, he's going to serve as Bishop of Rome for 21 years. He's going to die in 461 AD. He's buried in St. Peter's Basilica. I read one place where his body's been moved 3 times because of building and all this kind of stuff, but his body is still there someplace, so I'm sure you can go see it if you wanted to, or maybe see the marker for him and that kind of thing. Now, the last thing I had, and this was just real quick, this is the tome of Leo. And again, this is basically a belief statement. And Leo, as he writes this tome, he's going to actually call out Eudocles in this, but he does it. He's not completely disrespectful. He does say that he's wrong, but he doesn't call him a bunch of nasty names or anything like that. But there are some things in here that I thought were good to just share with y'all regarding the belief on the dual nature of our Savior. And one of the things he writes in here, it says, accordingly, while the distinctiveness of both natures and substances was preserved and both met in one person, lowliness was assumed by majesty, weakness by power, mortality by eternity, and in order to pay the debt of our condition, the inviolable nature was united with a passible one, so that as the appropriate remedy for our ills, one and the same mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus, might from one element be capable of dying, and also from the other be incapable of dying, that is. He assumed the form of a servant without defilement of sin, enriching what was human, not impairing what was divine, because that emptying of himself, whereby the invisible made himself visible, and the Creator and Lord of all things willed to be one among mortals, was a stooping down in compassion, not a failure of power. For each of the natures retained its proper character without defect, and as the form of God does not take away the form of the servant, so the form of the servant does not impair the form of God. Kind of in closing, and this was one of the things he really wanted to push to the blood of Christ in terms of the need for that. He said, "Let him listen also to the blessed Apostle Peter when he declares the sanctification by the Spirit takes place through the sprinkling of the blood of Christ, and let him not give a mere cursory reading to the words of the same Apostle, knowing that ye were not redeemed with corruptible things as silver and gold from your vain way of life received by the tradition of your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as a lamb without blemish and without spot." So there's a lot more here that he wrote, but we're short on time to a certain extent. But that's what he was writing about, the dual nature of our Savior, especially from the human side, because that was the side that they were trying to diminish. And finally, this is a statement that he made in one of his sermons. And I want, in just closing, I want y'all to understand the man that this was, because Leo really didn't brag about himself. Those things that we saw about Attila the Hun and Genseric, he didn't write anything, at least we don't have any writings with him espousing how great I did a job on this kind of thing. These were other people writing about the incidents. But this is what he wrote when he found out about becoming the next bishop of Rome. It says, "His feelings at the assumption of this high office, he himself thus describes in one of his sermons, 'Lord, I have heard your voice calling me, and I was afraid. I considered the work which was enjoined on me, and I trembled. For what portion is there between the burden assigned to me and my weakness, this elevation and my nothingness? What is more to be feared than exaltation without merit, the exercise of the most holy functions being entrusted to one who is buried in sin? Oh, you have laid upon me this heavy burden. Bear it with me, I beseech you. Be my guide and my support." So that's Leo. He appears, at least from everything I read, he appears to be a humble man. I don't know that he exactly envisioned how Rome would grow. He was concerned about the unity of the church, and he saw that in terms of government, how structured everything was with a top-down kind of thing. And I imagine that's how he envisioned the church as well, having a top-down type structure. I don't know that for sure, Pastor. It's just a kind of a subjective guess of mine. But do y'all have any other questions about Leo or anything like that? I appreciate your time and attention. Thank you, and you are dismissed.